You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the latest episode of the City of Man podcast. I am Edward Song, and I teach in the philosophy department at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. Things are a little different today. First of all, my regular co-host, Coyle Neal, is not with us. In his stead, I'm joined by my Westmont colleague, Samir Yadav, who is a theologian in the religious studies department. Samir has degrees from Yale and Duke Divinity School and works on issues of religious experience and moral theology. Welcome to you, Samir.
Thanks, Ed.
I'm going to ask you a question that I sometimes ask my students on the first day of class just to get to know them. It's an indirect way of peering into their souls. And so here's the question. What's your favorite breakfast cereal?
Ah, that's tough. I have been known to enjoy Fruity Pebbles.
Fruity Pebbles.
Yeah, my mom was one of those cool moms who let us have sugary cereal.
Uh-huh.
And so... So that's stuck with me.
Okay. Fruity Pebbles.
Fruity Pebbles, yeah. It's been good love.
The milk is extraordinary after.
Yeah, it does some things there. Yeah, rainbow and so on.
While Samir and I could probably do a whole episode talking about breakfast cereal, we are very pleased to be sitting here with Nicholas Waltersdorf. Nick Waltersdorf is the Noah Porter Professor of Philosophical Theology Emeritus at Yale Divinity School, where he taught until 2002. Before arriving at Yale in the late 80s, he spent 30 years teaching at his alma mater, Calvin College. Since his retirement from Yale, he has been a senior fellow at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture at the University of Virginia. It is fair to say that Nick Waltersdorf is one of the most important Christian philosophers in the United States over the last 50 years, and he is the intellectual or spiritual godfather to several generations of Christian philosophers and theologians. Nick, along with Alvin Plantinga and others, helped to defend the rationality of religious belief in the 70s and 80s in a way that provided both personal and intellectual support for Christians in the discipline. I think this is the main reason why there are so many more prominent Christians working in academic philosophy than you would find in virtually any other academic discipline. In an age in which academics from all different disciplines have set their spades in the same plot of land, Nick has written in just about every area of philosophical inquiry: aesthetics, metaphysics, epistemology, the history of philosophy, philosophy of education, philosophical theology, and then, especially over the last 20 years or so, political philosophy and theology. Nick has been the president of the Central Division of the American Philosophical Association and of the Society of Christian Philosophers. He is also a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He has given the Wilde Lectures at Oxford, the Gifford Lectures at St. Andrews, the Stone Lectures at Princeton Seminary, and is the author of something like 20 books. Maybe it's more than 20 books. And scores of articles. We are very grateful to have Nicholas Waltersdorf on our show today.
Thank you, Ed, and Samir.
So it's interesting in a lot of ways. Your academic career started out and you were writing about issues of... metaphysics in the beginning?
Yeah, I began writing about metaphysics, that's right.
And then some aesthetics early on as well?
Yeah, so it was grad school that got me interested in metaphysics. I went to Harvard as a grad student. Logical positivism, I won't try to explain that now unless it becomes necessary, sure. was in its heyday. But the professor that I was especially fond of was D.C. Williams, who was by no means a positivist. Williams' attitude was, this too shall pass, he took it to be a fad, and so forth. Williams was a metaphysician of the classical type. One went through classical metaphysics from the ancient Greeks up to recent, and that got me interested in metaphysics. So my first love and my first writing was indeed, you're right, in metaphysics.
And then through the heart of your career in the 80s, most people think immediately of your work in epistemology, and especially sort of defending the rationality of religious belief. One of the interesting things about your career is that you've moved and covered so many different topics. Over the last 20 years, since the mid-90s, I guess, around about, you've been writing in a pretty focused way in political philosophy.
Yeah, so what's happened in my career, Ed, was this. Whereas a good many philosophers are, especially of the Germanic type, let's say, are inner-directed. They've one thing leads them on to another, and they pay little attention to what's happening in the outside world other than what other philosophers are saying about their work and mm-hmm. so forth. In my case, I have found myself called to respond to, as it were, things that dropped on my doorstep. Not mm-hmm. things that I sought out, but things that dropped on my doorstep. Hence it was that I, through some fluky occasions, got involved in aesthetics and epistemology, and then later, you're right, political philosophy. In each case, I could spell out what the episode was, what the incident was that got me interested in it. But yeah, so that's why. Well, I haven't talked about everything. I haven't written about philosophy of science or philosophy of mind or anything like that. So I've got my limits.
Well, there's still time yet.
So would you say that that your what occasions your directedness in terms of your intellectual interests then just is purely a matter of extrinsic kind of episodes rather than any there? Have you found yourself in one area, say aesthetics, and then that becoming the launching point for something different?
No, it's been more the former, Samir. So aesthetics, that happened like this. I was teaching philosophy at Calvin. I had myself never taken an aesthetics course in my undergrad career or my graduate career. Aesthetics courses were being given. When I talked to students in those courses, it sounded like armchair psychology. And in fact, looking back, it really was heavily psychology of art, of aesthetics and so forth. And my feeling about that was, look, if I'm going to go into psychology, I'll go into psychology, not do armchair psychology. But then the person who was teaching aesthetics at Calvin College retired. My colleagues knew that I was interested in art. They said, Walterstorff, Nick, you teach it. What had also happened is that the year before, an acquaintance of mine, Monroe Beardsley, had published a book that he called Aesthetics. And this was clearly philosophical. It was not psychology. So it was those two things together, Monroe publishing this brand new book that he called Aesthetics, which was really philosophical mm-hmm. aesthetics, and my colleagues saying we need somebody to teach the course in aesthetics, mm-hmm. that led to my getting involved in aesthetics.
Mm. What's interesting, though, I've sort of observed about your corpus is that whereas topically there's a lot of distinction, you know, there's aesthetics is very different than, say, what you did in your philosophical theology on the claim that God speaks or this kind of thing, in divine discourse. But laterally, across many of these different projects, there's a similar conceptual infrastructure, you might say. So, for example, in your aesthetics work, you draw on some speech act theory to help make sense of mm-hmm. aesthetic mm-hmm. judgments. Mm-hmm. Whereas then in your work on, say, in Divine Discourse, mm-hmm. you also employ that same mm-hmm. machinery, so to speak, to talk about mm-hmm. God's capacity to speak by way of Scripture. And then even further in the kind of narrative theology kind of work that you've done, as I remember an essay in Faith and Narrative, that mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. book edited by Yandel, mm-hmm. and you also employ the same kind of conceptual machinery and then develop it in terms of world projection and this kind of stuff, which was also something that you had done in your Art of Action. So do you see much of this kind of lateral movement in your thinking across these various topics?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right about that. That's perceptive. So though the topics have been different, or areas, the subdisciplines of philosophy of art, political philosophy, epistemology, and so forth, there have been themes, I suppose you could call them, that straddle these different foci. And one of them has been speech act theory, the whole phenomenon of one thing counting as another, or by doing one thing, we also do another thing. Another one has been the notion of social practices runs across many of these. So when I talk about art, I talk about not just the works of art, but about the social practices of art. In epistemology, it became important for me to understand, if we're going to understand why it is that we say, but you shouldn't believe that, or you should have known that, in spite of the fact that beliefs are not under the control of the will, it became important for me to start talking about practices of inquiry, practices of coming to know, and so forth. Recently, I've been writing about philosophy of liturgy and worship, and there again, it's the practices of worship. So that especially interests me. So running throughout have been, you're right, a few themes. Speech act theory, social practices are two of them that come to mind right away. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And epistemology particularly, that emphasis on social practice became one way in which you, I think, contributed to a lot of what Plantinga did and sort of thinking about, I remember you have an essay on the belief-forming self in which
yes,
you talk about
yep,
the
yep.
belief-forming self has to be understood, not simply in terms of a sort of reliable mechanism of pumping out
yep.
beliefs, but one that's contextualized mm-hmm. within
yep, absolutely.
The framework. Yeah.
Yep, you're right. You're a good reader.
But there never was any kind of grand plan at the start of
right.
your career,
no,
periodically,
no,
in which
no,
you said,
too.
Oh, you know, at some point I'd like to write about.
No, I sometimes give the parody. It is a parody, a caricature of the classic German philosopher. Mm-hmm. It's always a male. He's 25 years old. He has the vision of a system,
uh-huh.
a 13-volume system. And so he works devotedly at that, does his best to screen out all interferences so that he can keep working at it. And he hopes that the completion of the 13th volume and his death will roughly coincide. The system will be complete, but he doesn't have to figure out what he's going to do with the rest of his life. That's a caricature. Though, it's a caricature that has some truth to it, as all caricatures do. So it's an extremely inner-directed.
Uh-huh.
That's the picture. And there are some philosophers like that.
Uh-huh.
I've just felt intuitively called to respond to some of the things, not everything, some of the things that just come my way.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so I know, so you wrote a book called Until Justice and Peace Embrace, and that came out in the
83, something
early
like that.
Early 80s. Well, maybe that was a lecture that you gave earlier on.
No, it was a set of lectures that I gave in Amsterdam.
Right, right. And I know that those, you write about this, well, I guess you probably read this in a few places, but at least in the beginning of the more recent book on justice, that arose out of a relatively chance meeting of black South Africans in one instance. And
yes,
of course, so this is in the late 70s then.
Mid-70s, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So apartheid era.
Yep.
And then another chance meeting with a group of Palestinians.
That's right.
And that sort of sparked curiosity about issues of justice, I think.
It's what I've thought and written about justice comes out of those two unexpected chance meetings with people of color in South Africa and Palestinians in 75 and people of Palestinians in 78.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I didn't go out looking for such people. It was not part of my agenda to start writing about justice. It came to me.
Mm-hmm. Two conferences, I think, right?
Two conferences,
yeah.
Yes.
And so you wrote that book in 83, and then over the 80s, a lot of stuff, especially in religious epistemology, and or epistemology of religious belief. And then we get to the 90s, and then you start writing about political theory again.
Yeah.
And did that happen because you sort of felt like there were questions that came out in the first book that you wanted to continue to address, or was that again happenstance?
In that case, it was a combination of the two. In that first book, Until Justice and Peace Embrace, I talked about justice. I said a little bit about the nature of justice, but I felt that it was basically unsatisfactory. Well, I thought it was true, but undeveloped.
Mm-hmm.
And I had it in my mind, you know, sometime I should really
mm-hmm.
Back up a little bit and mm-hmm. think seriously about justice and not just employ the concept, which is what I was doing then. So then two additional things happened. Well, one of them was a background point. I was, from my college days on, reared in the tradition of Abraham Kuyper, a Dutch theologian, politician, publicist, activist, and so forth. And Kuyper's understanding, vision of how the Christian engages in society, especially political action. So that was in the background. And then a political philosopher at Notre Dame, Paul Weithman, good friend, set up a conference on liberalism in the mid-80s, invited me, I don't remember why he invited me, but invited me to give a talk. And that sort of spurred me to start working seriously at the political philosophy and at political philosophy and justice and so forth. That's when I finally read John Rawls. Mm-hmm. What I'd written about justice before was written without having read John Rawls. It was Paul's coming to me and saying, well, we were friends, we talked. I think it was Paul saying, Nick, I think this is the occasion for you to start thinking seriously about political philosophy. Uh-huh. And that's what I did. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so Rawls at that time in the 90s had, well, I guess he had been brewing these ideas for some time, but then his big book, Political Liberalism, came out in something like 1993, at least the first edition.
And that book was out before Weithman's conference. So Weithman's conference must have been in 95 or something like that.
Okay. Yeah, okay. And probably in large part was wrestling with the ideas that were...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so that book's really controversial. It's kind of hard to unpack.
Yes.
All the ways in which...
It's a very dense book.
Yeah, Rawls famously wrote A Theory of Justice in the early 70s, and he develops this liberal egalitarian theory of justice. And the content of that theory doesn't change, but the way in which we think about that theory changes.
Right.
In ways that are going to be hard to explain.
Right.
In 30 seconds. But the really controversial thing, especially for Christians, was his account of public reason that he gave in that book. That was the object of... a book that you wrote with
Bob Audy, right?
With Bob Audy. That was a point counterpoint book in which you were sort of debating. Audy was more or less sympathetic with Rawls's account, and you were
so that book emerged like this. So at this conference that Paul Weithman set up in, let's say, 1995, few years after the first edition of Rawls's Political Liberalism, at the same conference, Robert Audy must have given a paper, taking a quite different position from the position I had taken. Mm-hmm. And then...
Roughly sympathetic with Rawls.
Yeah, I was not sympathetic with Rawls. Audy was. A person on the philosophy staff at Notre Dame, Jim Sterba, was editing a point-counterpoint series for Roman Littlefield.
Yeah.
So Sterba came up to me and Audy got us together and said, how about a point-counterpoint series? And that's what, that's how the book, what is it called? Religion in the religion in the public square emerged. Yeah.
Yeah. So Rawls's view is that when we are in the public square debating, well, the technical language is constitutional essentials or matters of basic justice, when we're debating about what the state should do, the language that we should use with each other, citizens, this is true of citizens, it's true, especially true of legislators, and especially true of judges and people running for office, but that we should try to use, well, what Rawls calls public reasons.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So reasons that don't arise out of what Rawls calls our comprehensive moral and philosophical commitments, right? So if you're a Christian, reasons that are really sort of inflated by a biblical or theological normative vision. And instead, the kinds of reasons that we should use are the kinds of basic political ideals that we find in our public political culture.
Yeah, the ideas embedded within the very idea of liberal democracy.
Right.
Right.
And then the idea is that because we all live in liberal democracies, we share these ideas.
Exactly. Or at least most of us do.
Yes. We hold these ideals for different reasons. So the Christian holds them for Christian reasons. A secular Kantian holds them for secular Kantian reasons, etc. But we sort of all agree on these. And because we all agree on these, they offer a kind of a normative lingua franca where we can have these debates.
Yeah, Rawls called it an overlapping consensus.
Exactly.
A consensus by virtue of the overlap on this point of our different comprehensive perspectives, right?
And you're very critical. So that's like this super controversial thing that comes out of the later Rawls, and you're very critical of that view.
Yeah.
Because
one reason for being one of my reasons for being critical of it is that it seems to me it simply doesn't go that way. I don't think the reasons that are embedded in liberal democracy are sufficiently thick. I mean, there are some. I don't think that they're sufficiently thick for us to settle packs of political disputes. Mm-hmm. So I don't think political, reason is sufficiently thick. But also it seems to me that the very idea of a liberal democracy is that citizens are entitled to think and speak mm-hmm. about political issues from their own comprehensive mm-hmm. religious or non-religious perspective. So it was the stifling. Now, Rawls backed off. In the first edition of Political Liberalism, he said that we should not use our religious reasons for debating significant issues of justice and so forth, but should use these reasons that we agree on, supposedly. In the second edition, he introduced a proviso. It's okay to use religious reasons provided you stand ready to appeal to public, sort of IOU.
Yeah. So you offer one at a later date, or
yeah,
there's a
public when that original conference occurred that Paul Weitzman set up, we didn't have the second edition
the
yet. Yeah.
And is the proviso a position that you're more sympathetic?
Well, it makes the position more acceptable, it seems to me. But still, my concern is that it seems to me that the ideas embedded in liberal democracy are simply not sufficiently thick to settle lots of our political issues.
Uh-huh.
And it seems to me that another one of the worries you raised, though, has to do with the kind of gag order that it represents.
Yeah, yeah.
So it sort of is a way of putting a priori constraints on what's permissible to...
Yeah, and what I observe in some of my later writings is that in a liberal democracy, the government doesn't do much to teach its citizens how to debate political issues. They learn in churches and schools and knitting groups, I suppose, and so forth. And take churches. Well, in churches, people don't learn to use public reason. They learn to use theological principles, biblical principles, and so forth. Some of them get pretty good at that. And now suddenly you ask them to employ public reason. Why should one expect that they know how to do that? Why should one expect that they know how to extract the relevant principles from the very idea of liberal democracy when, in fact, they've been trained to use biblical principles mm-hmm. to do it?
Mm-hmm.
So if you were really serious about the Rawlsian program, presumably there'd have to be a big cultural push, a big educational push to teach people how to employ public reason.
Yeah, I mean, so the thing that motivates Rawls, I mean, Rawls, of course, is worried about the kind of pluralism and diversity that characterizes life in modern democracies,
yep.
and the kinds of social, very deep social conflicts
yep.
that arise.
And that's an appropriate worry.
Yeah, yep. And that, but even more than that, right, the idea is that in a liberal democracy, the state exercises coercive power against its citizens, and in a liberal democracy, that coercive power needs to be justified.
Sure,
right, and so. Like the thing that motivates us is this concern that it's important when we're talking about the state exercise of coercive power that power is explicable to people in terms that they can accept, right? So there's a kind of as citizens in a liberal democracy, we share a kind of an obligation or a duty to each other when we're advocating for particular public policies that are going to be backed by the coercive power of the state. To really try to explain that, you know, to you, Samir, about, so this law is going to affect you, mm-hmm. and I support this law, and now it's incumbent upon me as a fellow citizen of you to try to explain the rationale behind that in terms that you can accept. And so, you know, here, this is all being written in the 90s. We find ourselves in the teens. Is that how do you describe this decade? Well, anyways, and
the preteens.
That's right.
That's an awkward state.
We're out of the tweens, but in the midst of an extremely contentious election and the kind of cultural conflicts that we were experiencing in the 90s have only grown more exacerbated. So I guess my question is, let's say we're having a debate about same-sex marriage, and the Christian just says, look, thus saith the Lord, no. Isn't that violating some kind of obligation that we have to each other as fellow citizens? And let's just set aside like the content and substance of that debate and just talk about the terms under which it's conducted. Is there anything wrong with, say, a Christian saying, look, thus saith the Lord, that's all I'm going to say about it?
So it seems to me that what happens in liberal democracy when it goes well is that we should do our best to explain our position to our fellow citizens and do our best to understand their position. Then at the end of that speaking and listening, responsible speaking and listening, what in fact always happens is that we still disagree. Mm-hmm. And then it seems to me what's crucial to a liberal democracy is that we take a fair vote. A fair vote. And the endurance of liberal democracy depends on the losers being willing to live with losing the vote. And that in turn depends on there not always being the losers on every issue. Mm-hmm. Now, a striking feature of Rawls and the public reason people is that they say almost nothing about voting. Mm-hmm. Whereas it seems to me voting is on my view, then voting is at the very heart of liberal democracy. We emerge with disagreements and then we take a vote that we hope and fair and try to make fair and so forth. So in my view, the vote is a crucial part of liberal democracy. I will not have succeeded in persuading all of my fellow citizens. They won't have succeeded in persuading me. Mm-hmm. So what do we do now? We vote instead of fight.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you might think is preserved. So, I mean, the first thought that strikes me about this kind of complaint about Rawls, a Rawlsian picture in that it prevents citizens from marshaling certain kinds of reasons, right? I mean, one kind of complaint you might have is that it is the kind that Ed is raising. But, I mean, one response that a Rawlsian might have, one response that somebody who criticizes Rawls might have is to say, well, the problem isn't that you can't give reasons of like, thus saith the Lord. You can give those. The problem is that you shouldn't expect that they'll actually be accepted by someone else.
Yep.
So it's still possible to say, it isn't that I shouldn't be allowed to marshal that reason. It's that having done so, I should have a reasonable expectation that someone who doesn't share my comprehensive vision has no, I've given them no reason.
I've given them no reason whatsoever.
Right. And so so it becomes a matter of tactics or strategy rather than of persuasion, rather than a matter of what's ruled in and out as a acceptable reason a priori.
My position is often characterized in terms of, well, aren't you just allowing people to say, thus saith the Lord, and that ends the debate and so forth. So there's a really interesting book of maybe 10 years ago by Robert P. Jones on the assisted suicide debate in Oregon. Mm-hmm. And he gets into the reasons that people actually gave for their positions, mm-hmm. and a lot of people gave religious reasons, but he doesn't quote anybody. There may have been some, but he doesn't quote anybody who just says, "Thus saith the Lord." Right. Everybody that he quotes knew that they had to say something more than just that. They had to point to something about assisted suicide that would make the Lord say, "This is bad." So I think it's a caricature. But I don't doubt that sometimes some people in the dialogue will say, God said it, so it's, God forbade it, so it's wrong, period, and I don't want to talk about it anymore.
So what would you say?
I think that's a deep dishonoring of one's fellow citizens, not to say, I'm not even going to listen to you, and I'm not going to try to say anything whatsoever that will be cogent for you.
Yeah.
So one thing that the Rawlsian might, I think, is reasonably reply is to say, okay, so say that we don't demarcate what counts as a public reason and not a public reason, that any reason is viable in the public square. And then we take this in the direction that you suggested, that we have this public dialogue about some policy issue, but then we got to vote, right? And then the result of the vote ends up being the will of the people, and that's how it goes. So what might get lost is if you don't have principled public reasons, then what you might lose is democratic culture, a public culture. So that if then what happens is that through just population shifts or various sociological reasons, you happen to have a group of people whose public reasons end up being mostly Christian or mostly whatever, then the minority cultures that exist in that context, in which you have a dominant culture and a minority culture, the dominant culture's comprehensive vision is always going to win. And so the fairness of the vote can, viewed from that macro framework, can be one that leaves out people. Sure. And whereas if you have an account of public reason, what you have is something like a public political culture that doesn't allow that to happen, that ideological control over the vote. What would you say about that kind of...
Well, so let's back up a little bit. So Rawls explicitly says in political liberalism, that what he's talking about is an idealized situation. He's not talking about actual societies. He's talking about idealized societies. And the picture that comes through to me when I read Rawls is that of a very well-ordered Yale University faculty meeting where people say to their colleagues, "My colleagues, I'd like to present to you the following thoughts for your consideration." And then people say, "I've listened to your thoughts, and I would like to present to you the following..."
Is this the way the following thoughts? Got, you know? I've never been to any...
No, I've not been. Like, so it's an idealized faculty meeting, right? So what's removed from the picture is what actually goes on. There's a book by Jeff Stout in the religion department at Princeton.
Democracy and Tradition.
No, after that.
Oh, after that.
In which he talks about actual public agitations for changes. What is the title of it? Well, I can't think of the title of it right now. It's a really good book in which Jeff talks about actual political action movements, and how complex they are. Emotions are involved. Blessed are the organized. It's a wonderful book in which he talks about how it actually goes, how pressure is involved, how you have to enlighten people. And also, I think, you know, I've got aunts and uncles who, they vote, they make political decisions, but they don't like to get into big debates about this. When I watch them, I think basically what they do is they listen for somebody, for a politician that they can trust, and they say, "I'm going to go with that." So it's this highly idealized picture, as I say, of a very well-ordered Yale University faculty meeting where... People.
Maybe the faculty meetings at Harvard were like that. But the philosophy department in the 90s at Yale was not
a well-ordered...
most certainly was not. Maybe Emerson Hall at Harvard.
So I think to get a more realistic picture on it, read Jeff Stout's Blessed Are the Organized, and then you see, this is how democratic politics goes. Uh-huh. And this is what we have to try to improve, and so forth.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that the normative heart of Rawls's account, and he kind of stumbles to it, but at the end, the thing with the proviso, I mean, the normative part of the theory is just that kind of disrespect that you talked about.
Yeah.
And that ideal, I do think, is important.
Yeah.
I think it's important for me, for example, to say to Yale acquaintances and so forth, explain to me how you're thinking about this issue.
Uh-huh.
And then I don't want to say to them, and please don't use any Jewish consideration.
Yeah, yeah,
please
yeah.
don't. I mean, I think that's simply not honoring them.
Yeah.
Tell me how you think as a Jew about this. Mm-hmm. And then I say, oh, now I've got to be fair to that in some way.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and I think it's that, like you say, that notion of fairness that's kind of at the heart.
Yeah.
And one thing that I think is important about Jeff Stout's work and that prior book, Democracy and Tradition, is that he exactly does identify something like a democratic culture tradition,
yeah.
a public sort of tradition,
of discourse and debate and so forth, and giving respect to and not demeaning your opponents and so forth.
And holding one another accountable.
Yep.
That it seems to me gets at what Rawls wants by way of this.
That's a good way of putting it. Yep.
Yeah.
So this might be a little bit of a superficial remark, but so I was well familiar with that work in the late 90s, sort of
with the Rawls
stuff, the stuff that was skeptical about Rawls. And then you worked your way in, and then you had this big book on justice that came out, in which you sort of defend a pretty systematic, worked out theory of
justice,
liberal theory of justice rooted in the centrality of human beings having intrinsic rights.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there was a part of me that was a little surprised, because it's a big liberal theory of rights.
Yeah. Well, why do you say it's a liberal theory?
Because it's rooted in the liberal idea that people have an intrinsic kind of...
Okay, yeah, that's true. Right.
Whereas I sort of thought of you in the 90s as being a little bit more of a hostile critic of philosophical liberalism. Is there any kind of shift that's going on there, or is that not right? I mean, you were objecting.
Yeah, no, I didn't think of it as a shift. I mean, earlier, I hadn't thought through what justice came to, so it wasn't as if I'd had a more whatever less liberal theory and then changed my mind. I just hadn't thought much about it. So I've never I didn't think of it as a change.
Uh-huh. I think one reason it might look like a change is because of the tendency to identify a liberal theory with a Rawlsian theory. And because you're critical of Rawls.
Yes, okay,
right?
Okay.
Then it could come to look...
Then, yeah. Yes, okay, right, right.
Or
right.
And a little bit more generally, the kind of hostility that Christian political theorists or Christian political theologians have towards liberalism.
Mm-hmm. So I distinguish between liberal democracy as a social political organization and liberalism as a certain theory about that, of which you might take Rawls as the paradigmatic example. So I'm a defender of liberal democracy, of that particular political social structure, but not of liberalism, if you think of that as Rawlsianism. I want to give a different account, different justification, if you will, of the political structure of...
Uh-huh.
And I try to do that in a later book, Understanding Liberal Democracy.
Right, which is a collection of essays.
Yeah. Well, collection of essays, but... More than half of them are brand new, so so they're essays, but half of them are written for the volume.
Yeah. I have a question. I have one question that I want to get to. I'll hold on off on that.
So I what happened then is I finally said to myself, I've been using this notion of justice, concept of justice all the time, employing it, appealing to it. It's time that I thought through what it is, what I think about it.
Well, so why don't we chase on and talk about that account of rights? Samir, do you want to kick?
Yeah, okay, so I did have a question about this. So aside from the kind of, you give a recovery in justice, rights, and wrongs, a recovery of a kind of theological grounding, you can give us a way of thinking theologically about individual rights-based theories of justice. But that approach can be contrasted with another competing kind of theory, various kind of competing theories. The most prominent of those you might think of as a communal right order kind of way of thinking about. Rather than thinking about rights as intrinsic properties of individuals, you can think about rights as conferred upon individuals by a rightly ordered kind of community.
Yeah.
And Oliver O'Donovan comes to mind as a prominent defender of this kind of picture, which he takes to be deeply rooted in the tradition. He gives an Augustinian kind of defense of this sort of picture and so on. But and another, I think, feature of O'Donovan's account that's unique and important is how much he attends to the biblical material in attempting to give a theological picture of a right order-based account. So he goes in his... what's the Desire of the Nations, I guess, is the name of the book. And he goes to do an Old Testament kind of context of Mishpat and gives this. Anyway, your interest in an intrinsic rights account as opposed to a right order account is also one that's theologically
right.
motivated, grounded. So What are your worries about something like O'Donovan's account, and are they primarily philosophical worries, or are they theological worries?
I suppose, well, they're a blend of the two. So the issue is, what's the deep structure of the moral order? Let me just put it like this, is it a top-down or a bottom-up structure? Is the deep structure that there's a set of laws, rules, obligations, principles, whatever, of fair distribution and so forth, and that this applies then to people when they are of a certain sort in a certain situation? Or is it a bottom-up structure in which human beings come with worth? Now, we don't have the right word in English for it, but come with worth, estimability, praiseworthiness, and so forth, which has to be honored. Now, when I look back on my own experience, it's clear to me experientially why the, let me just call it the bottoms-up account, appealed to me from the very beginning. My awakening as to issues of justice occurred, as you hinted, Ed, when I attended a conference in South Africa in September 1975, and after listening to the Afrikaners defend the system of apartheid, which was still in effect in 1975, then listened to the people of color in South Africa, who were present at the conference, speak of how they were treated with, how the whole system of apartheid treated them with gross indignity, and how there were, you know, apart from the system, how there were detailed incidents of ordinary contacts that treated them with indignity. So from the very beginning, I felt that it was these bruised, wronged people that were the, it was these bruised, wronged people that were prominent in my mind, not some system of principles, obligations, and so forth. And so that's autobiographically why, from the very beginning, I now see it was, it's those people and what was happening to them that seemed to me the heart of the matter. We could maybe generalize to some principles afterwards, but it didn't seem to me that the principles came first, but these, right. But these wronged people, what was happening to the people that was the fundamental ill.
Right.
Not that some rules were being violated, but these people were being abused. And hence, then, you've got, coming from antiquity, two basic ways of thinking about justice. One comes from Aristotle, and that's very much principles of distribution. Justice consists of equity and the distribution of burdens and benefits. And you've got the other coming from the Roman, 3rd-century Roman jurist Ulpian. Justice consists of rendering to each person what is his or her right or due or what's owed them. And that then starts from the persons. So Ulpian's from the very beginning, well, I hadn't, you know, when I had the South African experience, I hadn't read Ulpian yet,
right.
but when I did read Ulpian, I thought, yeah, this is it.
Yeah, yeah. Don't you think there's a way of, okay, so I mean, let's say I take O'Donovan's.
And so let me say one more thing.
Yeah, sure.
So then it seems to me that Scripture is, in fact, running throughout Scripture is this theme of human beings have worth. You'd be surprised when you look for it, you'd be surprised how often Scripture speaks of honor, honoring. Mm-hmm. And finally we get to first chapter of First Peter, where Peter says, honor everybody, mm-hmm. which in antiquity would have been utterly mm-hmm. astonishing. You honor the people above you in the social order. Now Peter is saying, everybody honor everybody. Masters are to honor slaves, and slaves are to honor masters, and so forth. So and Paul in Romans 13, honor the authorities. Pay honor where honor is due, and so forth. So one would be the notion of human beings as having worth, any radical worth, which requires honor, is really a deep theme in Scripture. Mm-hmm. There's also the theme of God's laws and so forth. But
mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm trying to think of how to best frame a kind of. I'm trying to think, okay, so what would somebody like an O'Donovan want to say about the intuition that they're capturing here?
Well, so the idea is that a right order theorist is perfectly happy to say that people have rights.
That's right.
Right? But they're just conferred.
That's
they,
right.
They descend on them, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean...
They're bestowed or conferred or whatever.
You know, and
I think the point can be put in a Walter Storffian way. So
So let me take an insight you raise in a different context and show you how it might be relevant in this one. All right. So this is again maybe this lateral thinking thing, but so we mentioned a while ago this point that you put to Al Plantinga about the belief forming self as being an intrinsically social and practical social practical kind of configured person rather than just some a person per se just, or something
yep.
like that.
Yep.
Transpose the same point in the context of a political theory, you might think of the Hobbesian state of nature or something. That is to say, there's no such thing as a state of a pre-social state of nature that we exist in. There's no something in which we are not already kind of ordered socially. And so the point about right order is to say that just as you might say we have worth, value, and so on, as persons intrinsically, the question there, you might ask a prior question, well, what is it in virtue of which we have that intrinsic worth? And it might be in virtue of a certain particular kind of social ordering that we have. That is experienced a certain kind of damage that obscures. So I mean, we can translate the intuition you had in the story you mentioned earlier, in which what is the intuition we have when we see that it's the system that had this system that's badly configured that is damaging the worth of the people who are adversely affected by it. Well, what's happening there is that there is a rightly ordered human community within which those people would not be experiencing that, and it's the lack of absence of that is occurring to us. That this, that when we say this just isn't right, what we mean is that some system is being badly ordered with devastating effects for those who participate in it. But the system is the primary thing.
Yeah, so both Alistair McIntyre and O'Donovan, McIntyre more pointedly than O'Donovan, suggests that the idea of a natural right is the idea of a right that you have wholly respective of living in society. That's not how I think of them. I, there are no such human beings. A natural right is a right that one has just by virtue of being a human being. And you're not going to be a human being living outside society. It's
right.
And then the rest of it is, Samir, this. Suppose you agree, as Christians, Jews, and Muslims do, that every human being bears the image of God and that gives them worth. Then it seems to me it just follows that worth has to be honored. And that worth is not bestowed on them by some system of rules, some social order or something. It's that they, each and every one, living in a community as they do, bear the image of God intrinsically, just by virtue of being human beings. So it's not... I think there's more... Not all rights are natural rights. Not all rights are grounded in the image of God. But the deepest ones of all are just we come with this worth. Mm. We human beings come with this worth, which has to be honored.
Yeah.
And it's not bestowed on us, it's just in us, yeah. or whatever you want to say.
So can I jump in there? So, like, when you put the point that way, like, that's a very deeply attractive way of putting the point. And I think one of the interesting things about the books is that we often think of the philosophical tradition of thinking about rights as being sort of very, like, a very modern innovation.
Yeah.
And one of the points in the book is say, no. You know, you look at the genesis of the rights tradition in the modern liberal political theorists, and they're picking up on something from the medieval jurists.
Yes, yes.
And that tradition actually isn't like some secular enlightenment modernist principle.
Right.
That comes from the medievalists. And where do they get it? They get it from the Christian and Hebrew scriptures, right?
And in between from the church fathers, who don't actually use the word rice. At least I've never come. Well, except incidentally. But when John Chrysostom, in his sermons on the parable of Lazarus, says that the extra shoes in the closet of the wealthy person belong to the poor person who has no shoes, I don't know how else to construe belong to than that he has a right to them.
Yeah.
One way to address to the same kind of point that I was making earlier is to say, okay, so in virtue of what is that belong? I mean, what explains the belonging, though?
John doesn't say, but I assume that he means they're created in the image of God, and you would be dishonoring them.
Right.
You would not be paying them due honor if you just refuse shoes.
Yeah, yeah. I think that one thing that's helpful to do to make the picture, to clarify your picture is, as opposed to something like O'Donovan's, is to ask the question whether it's you think of it as compatible with the rights, the intrinsic rights picture that you defend, to suppose that humans are essentially social beings.
Yes, I do.
See, so I think that's what...
They are essentially social.
There's something, I think that one of the things that goes along with an intrinsic rights-based, the critiques of an intrinsic rights-based theories is this idea that it somehow construes humans as in an individualist kind of
terms.
Yeah,
I've never understood that. Right. Well, I do in a way understand it. But so two responses. One is, on my understanding of rights, rights are intrinsically social. To have a right to something is the right to be treated a certain way by my fellow human beings. And so you need two. Except you can wrong yourself. Except in the limiting case, you need at least two for rights. They are intrinsically social. So I think what's happened is this. For reasons that I don't understand, the story emerged somewhere along the line, probably early in the 20th century. The story emerged that the idea of natural human rights was an invention, discovery, whatever, of the secular Enlightenment. And one finds that story told all over the place. To this day, it's told by O'Donovan and McIntyre and by those who are not Christian. So as Ed was suggesting, we now know as a result of studies of the canon lawyers of the 12th century that it was not an invention of the Enlightenment. The canon lawyers were explicitly using the notion of natural rights, the rights of the poor, spousal rights, the rights of immigrants, of aliens, and so forth. So then what happens is that two people, John Witte, writes thick, fat volumes about the employment of the conceptuality of rights in the early Reformation, book of his, The Reformation of Rights. And Richard Tuck talks about the employment of the conceptuality of rights by the Spanish theologians, by the progressive Spanish theologians who were arguing against what Spain is doing to the natives in South America. So here's a question that I put to historians. If that's all right, if that's all correct, the conceptuality of natural human rights becomes explicit in the 12th century. It's employed by the Spanish theologians who are opposing the conquest and by the early reformers all over the place. John Witte says that there's not a single natural right that's recognized by later writers that wasn't recognized by the second generation Calvinist reformers. Mm. Here's a question I put to historians. If that's all true, why did the amnesia, when and where and why did the amnesia set in? If that's all true, why does it seem plausible to lots of Christians, intelligent, educated Christians, McIntyre and O'Donovan, that it's a discovery of the Enlightenment? How did the amnesia set in and why? And no historian has given me a good answer to that question.
I'm not an historian. and so I suspect it has something to do with how what we mean by nature, because when we talk about nature and something's being natural, one of the one way of understanding sort of Enlightenment conceptuality surrounding nature as it relates to human norms is that there needs to be a project of regrounding, and this is a Kantian
yeah.
kind of thing. And so the project of regrounding moral concepts, norms that govern human social relationships as norms that are described at, in terms of nature on the model of the natural sciences. And so on the model of the natural sciences, to understand something as natural is to understand it as law-governed, nomologically governed in a way that makes no reference to...
Yep.
Yeah. And so if you think of that conception of nature and then you think of rights as being natural in that sense, then you can think of it as an essentially Enlightenment project.
Yeah.
Whereas my, you know, having not read Tuck and so on, my suspicion would be that the concept of nature that's being employed doesn't function that way.
Yeah, it could be. Authors. And maybe when the French revolutionaries began talking about the rights of man, mm-hmm. it may be that in people's mind, the whole notion of rights got associated with revolutionary politics and so forth. But still, there had to be a forgetting. Mm-hmm. There had to be a massive forgetting that Heinrich Bullinger, Calvin's successor, is talking about rights all over the place. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, that's a historical puzzle.
Right. Right, but I think that if you do think of the Enlightenment as itself a movement in, that is an intentional forgetting, that is to say, mm-hmm. in one way of thinking about it is to say that, you know, it's an intentional forgetting about theological...
And in a certain way it was. When Locke talks about rights, he doesn't remind his readers that I'm just carrying on a thick Protestant Catholic tradition.
Exactly, exactly. So what becomes... necessary to foreground in one's reasoning about what we mean by a right or something like that, to foreground certain principled ways of arriving at that don't make reference to...
And when the Declaration says we hold these truths to be self-evident,
exactly.
mm-hmm. as opposed to we with our theological
right.
tradition.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Locke didn't need to explain those things because he didn't need to explain those things.
Right? Yeah. Right.
And nowadays, everybody reads the second treatise on government, nobody reads the first treatise yeah. on government, which
yeah.
is the more explicitly sort of work of political.
Yeah, so I mean,
it's right. The first treatise is thick, is a thick theological polemic, yeah.
And this is actually leads to something, a kind of ironic result here that McIntyre, for example, perhaps he's actually complicit in this intentional forgetting
yes,
of
yes.
the Enlightenment, precisely in virtue of not recognizing the Christian traditional origins. So
I have never heard McIntyre or O'Donovan respond to Brian Tierney's
uh-huh.
work. Have you?
No.
Because it seems to me that the Tierney stuff is so decisive.
Yeah.
It's so chock full
uh-huh.
of quotations of 12th century canon lawyers talking about
it. The fact that it's 12th century is important, too, because high medieval sort of thinking about this already belongs to a kind of fall narrative for McIntyre.
Yeah,
this,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Of,
well,
you know,
the
turn and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, the classic Neo-Thomas picture is that St. Thomas is the apogee, and after that it's all been done.
That's right.
With these bad people, Scotus and Ockham.
Right,
and,
right, that's right.
So, like, one of the things that I find really interesting about the book is that sort of recovering that idea, and especially amongst a particular kind of academic Christian political theorist, a theologian. Like, all of my peers who are, like, about my age and doing political theory, Christian political theorists, they always mutter liberalism with a kind of a snarl, you know. It's like, but it's this recovery. It's like, no, that's our idea. And
Exactly.
Yeah, and the book is nice because, and you know, there are these chapters on the moral visions of the Old and New Testament and sort of
yep.
bringing
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
But here's my big question.
Yeah.
So, like, that whole story about inherent rights being rooted in our intrinsic dignity. It's rooted in the fact that we're made in the image of God. It's not bestowed. That's not the argument that you give in the book, though. And then the argument changes in Understanding Liberal Democracy, right? So in the end of the book,
of the
Big Justice book,
yeah.
You know, we were I taught that book in a contemporary political theory class. That class was the best. It's the best class I've ever taught.
Is it here at Westmont?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the best seminar I've ever taught. Maybe I shouldn't say that publicly. I love all my students as I love my children. I love them all equally. But anyways, and then that class, when we were talking about the theistic writing. It was the best single class I've ever taught in my life. Because it was building up to this big moment, right? So the crescendo of the book is this. And then you're skeptical about accounts that attempt to ground the idea of intrinsic dignity in the Imago Dei, right?
If you think of the Imago Dei as requiring capacities,
yes,
then I'm skeptical. So we have to re-understand the Imago Dei.
Uh-huh. And so to be made in the image of God isn't to have the capacity to do particular kinds of things. Say,
no, because I think the person who's in a permanent coma.
Yeah, that's right.
Who cannot function as a human being, who doesn't have capacities only capacities.
Now, I don't recall this from the book. Do you think that there are things like, you know, what Aristotle thinks of as capacities to have capacities? So if there's these kind of second order capacities, that is to say, what it is to have, there's a difference, say, between, I mean, think about a dog. There's a puppy who doesn't know how to fetch or whatever, but it can learn how to fetch, right? So, once it's learned how, it's not always exercising that, uh-huh. right? So it has the potential, it has the capacity to, that it's just not exercised. So that's
certainly true of a child.
Right. So you might say, you know, somebody who is permanently disabled or is in a coma, the kind of thing that they are, qua human, is the kind of thing that has the capacity to develop the capacity to something. And so then if you think, so Aristotle would say that when a human's in a coma, then, you know, the kind of damage that's been done to them is that they don't have the capacity to do something, but they're still the kind of thing that could have the capacity to help.
Yeah. So it seems to me that the person in a permanent coma does not, in fact, any longer have the capacity to exercise the capacity
or to acquire it.
Right. They've lost that.
Right.
What I do think is the case, and this is my argument, is that even that human being retains human nature. Mm-hmm. And if we explore what human nature is, it is, well, a person who has well-formed human nature can love, can think, can be loved, receive love, and so forth. So I think we have to have a sort of nature understanding of the Imago Dei rather than a capacity understanding of Imago Dei.
And so one of the things that the book also does is that it offers up these skeptical accounts of secular attempts to ground human dignity.
Right.
And capacities.
Yeah. And a lot of those arguments are capacity-based. So that capacity arguments gets used to critique these secular theories.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But then, so the argument that you give, this is super interesting to me, and it's helping to clarify. So then you make the point that the value that we have comes from the fact that we're beloved by God.
So let's talk a bit about this nature. So the analog I give, so how do we think about it? The analog I give there is...
Mercedes-Benz example.
Yeah, the fellow who's got a neighbor. Let's see, how does it go? Oh, he himself doesn't own a Mercedes-Benz,
uh-huh.
but he's got a neighbor to the west who owns a Mercedes-Benz,
yeah.
and he's got a neighbor to the east.
See, that example isn't very impressive in Montecito, because Mercedes-Benzes
right.
are like Hondas here. We need
yeah, exactly.
What do you want, a Jaguar?
Something,
or
Lamborghini or a Ferrari. Ferraris here in the way that I used to see Mercedes-Benz.
So the one guy's got this really humming Ferrari, and he really admires it. The other is... The other guy had one and got in a wreck,
yeah.
but he was very fond of it, so he had the people haul it back into his garage.
Yeah.
Now, what I say to him, what I say to that neighbor of mine, hey, I think you ought to preserve it.
Yeah.
It's a wreck, but you know, it's...
It's a Ferrari.
It's a Ferrari, a wrecked Ferrari, but I think you ought to treasure it, put a tarp over it,
uh-huh.
lift up the tarp once a year on the anniversary of the wreck and so forth.
Mm.
I think I would not say that. So that's why I think we have to add something more.
Yeah.
And the more is that each and every human being, whether or not they can still function as a person, God wants to have as a friend, is beloved by God, as someone that God wants to befriend. I think that's, well, I mean, there are theologies which would dispute that. I know that very well. But that seems to me the testimony of Scripture. And I quote a nice sentence or two from Karl Barth, which he says exactly that.
Yeah.
Doesn't that account raise a further question, which is what's motivating God's desire to
pray? Yeah.
Why does God? I mean, so what's the ground of the divine desire?
Because when impediments are lifted, impediments to friendship are lifted, impediments of various sorts, moral impediments, physiological impediments, and so forth. Human beings are of a nature, here we go back to nature. Human nature is such that God can be friends with these creatures, whereas alligators are of a nature such that God can't in any significant way be a friend with them. They can be loved, alligators can be loved by God, but not in the friends sort of way.
Yeah, so that's an argument that you give in an essay in the Understanding of Liberal Democracy book. That book also, it changes slightly. So in the Justice book, this is so narrow and technical, but this has been haunting me for a couple of years. So the account here, you say it's about love which bestows a particular kind of value on the beloved. And then in the Understanding Liberal Democracy book, it's terms of the language switches to honoring, I think.
Yeah, so I think what happens then is that by virtue of God wanting this creature as a friend, that's a way of honoring this creature.
Right.
And then you and I have to, just as if I appoint you, I don't know, a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, that's...
Can you do that? That would be awesome.
Not by myself. Not on my, as we say, not on my own authority. That's to bestow a certain honor on you.
So, do you understand your view changing much between the essay and the book?
I understand the Understanding Liberal Democracy to be a substantial refinement of what I say in Justice.
A refinement, but a substantial refinement.
Well, yeah. I think there in Justice I just talk about love or bestowing love.
Uh-huh.
I think I'm more precise. It's wanting as a friend.
Okay. But, yeah, and then the big objection, which Samir mentioned, is, well, could God have wanted to befriend just anything? Could it have...
Mosquitoes
or alligators?
No.
And then the answer
God,
is no.
God may love all of them. That's what was somewhat undeveloped. God may love all of them, but friendship is...
But now that starts to sound a little bit like a capacity argument.
Yes, because by virtue of their nature, they have the capacity. Their nature gives the capacity. The nature may be impaired, and there will in addition be moral impairments. Uh-huh. So somehow or other, these impairments to friendship have to be dealt with.
Uh-huh.
The moral impairments,
sure. The
physical, physiological, mental impairments. But that's the hope of a future life.
Sure. But why not just? But the capacity to befriend us is always there.
Capacity to respond as a friend to God's wish. Yeah.
Why not just say...
No, the capacity is not always there. The nature is always there.
But the thing that gives us the value, why not just say, well, the thing that gives us the value is that we're made in the image of God.
Yeah, provided we understand image of God, not as requiring capacities.
Right.
Because I want to say that the person in the permanent coma still bears the image of God, even though they don't have the capacities of personhood anymore.
Right.
They still have the nature.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, I have to say I disagree with your intuition on the Mercedes-Benz example. Or the now updated
In the book I say there will probably be some people who disagree with me in that intuition. And for them, then, we don't have to talk about God's love, but just human
nature. Right,
so nature is sufficient.
Okay, so if I say Alan Nick is wrong about that, when we see the broken-down Ferrari, we say, oh, what a tragedy it is. That used to be a great car, but that's still something special, even though it's not what it could
and
be.
And so preserve it, honor it.
Uh-huh.
Pay obeisance once a year. Well,
sure.
Pay obeisance every day.
Polish it.
If that's your intuition...
Then you can stop there.
You can stop there.
Okay, but then if that's not your intuition, then you need the next little argument.
That's right, exactly.
We still have
That's then a satisfactory secular account of human rights.
But not secular, because then... Well, the story that the Christian can say
because
is...
The secularist then says they still have human nature.
Oh, okay.
But just like this, what's your car? Your Ferrari.
Yes.
It still has Ferrari nature.
It still has Ferrari nature.
That is, if you think of nature as a sort of model plan, as a paradigm, according to which it was built, constructed, whatever, then it's still, it is of the...
Okay.
So it is of the Ferrari model.
Uh-huh. So last like small technical question. And then the thought that I had is, when you reject that account and then you go to the values bestowed by God, then that starts to sound a little right ordery to me. Because now it's not intrinsic, it's coming.
Well, but then the human being does, if you are elected a fellow of the American Academy, then if you really do have about you something that's about you that has
you
to be honored.
In other words.
You put it on your CV, among other things.
Oh, that would be at the top of my CV.
Yeah. Before your name.
That's right. It would be on American Academy letterhead.
That's right. But it strikes me that we're still talking about natures as involving... so as soon as you say, okay, what it is to have in human nature then is to... for there to be something about you that merits divine desire for friendship.
Mm-hmm. Right? I don't know if it merits
something
it.
That
it's
is
something I'm reluctant to call. Well, John Calvin says that the image of God calls forth merits God's love. At least it makes God's love appropriate.
That's what
in
I
a
mean,
way
it,
that
it
crocodile nature.
Right. Right.
They just. Even at their best, crocodiles can't.
Right, but so whatever it is about us that merits divine desire for friendship, that makes it appropriate for God to want that from us.
Yeah.
And not crocodiles or tables and chairs or whatever.
Yep.
It involves some reference to capacity. One that's unimpeded, one that's whatever. Mm. But it's a capacity that belongs to our design plan.
Yes, yes. Right? Even though you may not at the present... be able to exercise that capacity.
Yeah, and so...
because you can have the nature with... even though, I think of it like this. The nature involves, in well-formed specimens of the nature, having such and such capacities. But not every specimen having that nature has those capacities.
That's right. So
being a grizzly bear involves having four legs, but something might have happened to an actual grizzly.
Right.
He's still got grizzly nature,
but he's
got only three legs.
All this sounds to me entirely compatible with an Aristotelian conception of a nature.
Could be.
That relates, that's the way capacities are involved in an Aristotelian account of natures, I think. That is to say that it has this kind of whatever teleology that involves natures. Well, that can have been impeded, that can...
That's right, then that would be, so far as I can see, an adequate secular account of human rights.
Right, okay. So you're not saying then that a theological account of human rights as intrinsic to our nature is necessary to get rights, that there can be no secular account.
Well, it's because I'm a bit skeptical about Ed's intuitions about the Ferrari.
Hmm.
I think I'd be inclined to say... come on, ship it off to the junkyard.
Mm.
Yeah, it was built on the Ferrari design plan,
mm-hmm.
but it's a wreck. It can't function. Ship it off to the. Mm-hmm. It's because I disagree with Ed on that mm-hmm. I think that I add to it the love of God.
Mm.
But if all right, I think I say in the book, I can understand that people would disagree with my mm-hmm. intuition on this, and if so, then that an Aristotelian type account works.
Mm.
But the value that we have, it's because we're made in the image of God, you know. So what makes human beings particularly special,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to, I don't know, dolphins?
Mm.
I mean, I think dolphins are great, but. Deserving all, you know, all kinds of respect, but not the kind of respect that we accord humans.
Mm.
Right.
And the value that we have as humans specifically is because we're like God.
You weren't like God.
And then, I mean, that's a pretty good answer.
Intimately mm-hmm. like God in a way in which alligators are not.
Not any alligators I met when I was anyway. Do you have any more
no,
justice questions?
No.
That's helpful, that clarification.
All right, can we talk about Mighty and Almighty a little bit?
Sure.
So in the book, The Mighty and the Almighty, you try to develop a more specific account, right? So you've developed this theological, liberal account of justice, and in The Mighty and the Almighty, you specifically direct it to questions of political theology and
yep.
the justification of state authority.
Yep. Yep.
And that the argument that you offer there turns on this, well, so Romans 13 is obviously like the locus classicus
yep.
for those.
Yep.
And you offer a reading of what state authority is supposed to look like. Maybe you could sort of walk us through the way you think about
yeah.
the Romans passage.
So in the first place, I take retribution to be payback.
Mm-hmm.
Payback harm with harm. And I read Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount as saying, never, always return evil with good, harm with good. Do not return evil with evil. And then I read what follows as hyperbolic examples. Mm-hmm. If somebody steals your, if somebody forces you to go 1 mile, volunteer to go 2 miles. Here's a contemporary example, it seems to me, analog. Somebody steals your bike, offer them your car. Sort of, really? I mean, I'm not to pay back?
Mm-hmm.
No. With respect, so I think what's behind it is what I call the reciprocity code, which was popular in ancient Judaism, but also popular in pagan antiquity. Mm-hmm. Pay back good with good, return good for good and evil for evil. I read Jesus as saying about the positive side of it, return good for good. Well, yeah, okay. But Gentiles do that, no
yeah,
big deal.
That's easy.
That's easy. The other side, never pay back evil with evil. And then Paul in Romans 12 says exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
I simply don't see any way of interpreting this other than don't pay back. Don't get even. Don't pay back evil with evil.
Not just to individuals, but...
Well, so then we get to Romans 12 and 13. A lot of people have read Romans, I suppose most of the Christian tradition has read Romans 13 as saying that the state, however, is authorized to engage in retribution. And the way people have fitted that together, 12 and 13, even though Paul in Romans 12 says never pay back evil for evil, if there's to be vengeance, if there's to be payback, leave it to God, don't you engage in it, is to say, well, Paul is talking about individuals in Romans 12, whereas he's talking about the state in Romans 13 and what applies, and the rejection of retribution applies to individuals and not to the state. But when you look closely at Romans 13, Paul doesn't use payback language in Romans 13. He just doesn't use it. He doesn't say that the state is authorized to pay back. What it's authorized to do is to restrain wrongdoing. That's what has been authorized by God to do. So I draw the conclusion that you and I ought to do our best to get our states to stop thinking in terms of payback when it comes to the criminal justice system, and to think in terms of reproving people. Because in Leviticus already it says that we should reprove wrongdoing lest the wrongdoing spread, reprove it. But it doesn't say payback. So that's how I think of Romans 13
mm-hmm.
and its relation to the latter part of Romans 12.
Right, so it specifically licenses the state is to curb wrongdoing.
To curb wrongdoing and to praise, and thereby sort of automatically as a side benefit to encourage good doing.
Right.
One of the framing kind of features of that book is this discussion of Yoder, John Howard Yoder, and his way of thinking about, you know, about the a state interest in wrongdoing and how it relates to Christian identity and this kind of stuff. Now, I'm a Duke person. Stanley Hauerwas is one of my advisors.
Oh, wow. I can see what's coming.
And
Hauerwas is a devotee of Yoder.
Yeah, exactly. I myself am not exactly in the same way, but I have, I think, more sympathies than you do for a Yoderian picture. And so I had a question about this. It seems to me that in the introductory chapter of the book, you center on Yoder's account of revolutionary subordination.
Yeah.
And you, at the end of the day, you say that, so look, what Yoder gives us is just that, this appeal to revolutionary subordination without fleshing it out in terms of actual substance or content. It's just that's all you get is this this appeal to this notion. And I think in giving that kind of critique that you may be a bit too dismissive of the motivating thought behind Yoder's political theology. And I think it's one that he actually does flesh out in other works like The Christian Witness to the State, for example. This book here, The Christian Witness to the State. So maybe not in The Politics of Jesus so much, which is the work that you center on more. But the central thought of Stanley Hauerwas is one that he works out from Yoder's, I think, which is this idea that the church can be regarded as a kind of contrast society, as a kind of alternative social order. Now, maybe not one that can have an autonomous existence apart from the whatever political structures actually already exist. But it's one that's marked by a kind of alternative society that's marked by opposing injustice with a kind of nonviolent love of enemies that we find in Jesus. So when we read the Gospels, we see Jesus saying the kingdom of God is at hand. Well, what's the kingdom of God? Well, then he shows us by virtue of what he embodies and teaches about the love of enemies, which is to oppose injustice and oppression with self-giving, nonviolent love. And that is that individual kind of embodiment of what the kingdom of God is actually like that we find in Jesus is what we find inaugurated corporately in the church. So the church is a corporate version, representation of what Jesus gives to us in the gospel. So we are the body of Christ, and our social enacting of a kind of social relationship is an enacting of Jesus's life. And so that idea of a contrast society, one that we can find, maybe we see hints of it in, I think, civil rights movement and what I think and sometimes has been referred to as King's vision of the beloved community or something like that. That is a substantive way of thinking about.
Yeah, and so I don't have any disagreement with that, Samir. And I decided to focus on Yoder's The Politics of Jesus because that was the decisive book. I didn't mean it to be a full discussion of Yoder. And though I do say there what you report me as saying, my main point about Yoder was I went to Yoder when I wrote The Mighty and the Almighty. I figured I'd have to look at what Yoder says about political authority, the authority of the state. And the decisive book here would be The Politics of Jesus. So I read it closely, and to my surprise, I discovered that Yoder doesn't think the state has any authority. He thinks it's got power, but not authority. Why doesn't he think it's got authority? Because he identifies the state with Paul's fallen powers.
Mm-hmm. That were disarmed by Jesus.
That were disarmed by Jesus, these fallen powers. So he doesn't think of the state as subject to the influence of the fallen powers, which is how I think of it.
Yeah.
But he thinks of the state as identical with the fallen powers. It's intrinsic. So it's got power. But these powers that Paul talks about, they don't have authority.
Right.
Paul doesn't think they've got authority. They've got lots of clout. So that, it seemed to me, pretty clearly was how he was thinking, how he gets to the conclusion that the state has power and no authority.
Yeah.
And so that, for me, was the decisive divide between how I think of it and how Yoder thinks of it. And it might have been best for me not to say anything at all about
the revolutionary subordination.
Yeah, the sort of thin ethic that he's got in The Politics of Jesus, which gets thickened out in other books.
Right.
And it might have been better for me just to shut up and let it go. Let it go by saying there is no doctrine of political authority here. There's a doctrine of political power.
Yeah. So I mean, I think that if you want to,
and I'm not sure that Hauerwas differs on that. Well, he's never come very clear on that.
He's not very clear on that. Partially because he tends to write in a more
aphoristic.
Exactly. Yes. Which is difficult because when you want precision, but I mean, to take the Yoder's insight, tis what seems to me to be paradigmatic.
You mean the denial, the status power but no authority?
Yes, is to look at, say, Jesus' relationship to Caesar and this confrontation with earthly authority that you get on the cross, or the trial narratives of Jesus, and then him before Pilate and this kind of thing. And I think that Yoder's intuition is that when Jesus says, "My kingdom is not of this world," what he's not saying in the politics of Jesus, what he's trying to rule out, is what Jesus means is not, "My kingdom is therefore a spiritual kingdom, not an earthly one. It's one that's in hearts, not embodied." That's not the idea. Rather, what he means is something like earthly forms, or that is to say, human enacting of governments, always are inveterately unjust. That is to say, some people in any system of government enacted by us, some people are going to matter and some people are not going to matter. Some people are going to be at the center and some people are going to be at the periphery. And one of the things that makes Jesus's ministry and bringing the kingdom of God a contrastive to that picture is that he walks from the center to the periphery and makes those who are marginalized the center. And so he does, in doing this, he's trying to say the way in which we enact social arrangements is always unjust, and the kingdom of God is one in which that defies our present experience. It is one in which justice is actually done such that there are.
But I guess I would say that I think Jesus wants to say that even at their best, even political kingdoms at their earthly political kingdoms at their best, don't identify the kingdom of God with those.
Right.
They're connected.
Right.
But it's not the same.
Right. Right. And so it's this contrast, exactly this
now,
contrast.
Now, they also do horrible things. But even when they're doing good things, it's still not to be identified with God's kingdom.
I see. So, I mean, one way of putting that point is to say not that it's not even intended to be identified. Different. Because Yoder assumes that they are, that what earthly kingdoms are aiming at is something that is or ought to be what the kingdom of God aims at, but they fail.
Maybe they should aim at it, but I think we should take. I take seriously Paul's picture at the beginning of Romans 13.
Right.
Earthly governments are servants of God. They're not
antagonists always.
They're not antagonists, and they're not to be identified with it. They are deacons. They're mm-hmm. servants, mm-hmm. And they can be. At their best, they're good servants. Mm-hmm. They're called to be good servants, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they have authority.
Yeah, I mean, I think the useful thing about the Yoder, contrasting your picture with the Yoder picture, is actually at this stage of this of a conceptual distinction between the kingdom of God as somehow a critique of a substitution, replacement for something inadequate that of our present experience,
right?
Versus something that runs parallel to it, distinct from it, right?
Right. And the one is called to serve, to serve the other.
Right.
The human kingdoms are called to serve God's kingdom.
Right. So the theological beef with Yoder, then, it seems to me, is about that. It's about
well, first, that he doesn't think that ordinary political regimes have authority, as far as I can see.
Yeah.
Whereas I think Paul clearly says they do have authority, mm-hmm. the authority of being servants of God, called to be servants of God. And then secondly, this point that we're talking about, those two.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Ed, did you want to?
No, you want to follow up with your...
Yeah, so let's see, what was the second? There was another thing about that I wanted to ask about the...
About the Romans 13.
Yes, about the Romans 13. So, so let's grant that your reading of Romans 13 about the legitimate authority of government to prevent wrongdoing is correct.
Yeah.
Okay. So in your exegesis of Romans 13, you're suggesting that the God-given authority of government to establish justice is consistent with denying the government the right to execute retributive justice, the kind that Paul condemns in Romans 12. Right? The vengeance belongs only to the Lord.
Yeah.
So in keeping with Paul's statement that vengeance belongs to God alone, we can't think of the curbing of wrongdoing on the of government as being one that is aimed at retributed.
Payback, yeah.
Exactly.
Understanding retribution is payback.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so I had that in mind as I was reading the exegesis. And then when I was going through the text, the clause that...
The Romans text.
The Romans 13 text.
Yeah.
The clause that then popped out to me that I wanted to see you treat, but then I didn't see you treat, was this idea that the government does not bear the sword for nothing. This idea that... The question that came to mind was, do you think that there are non-retributive uses of the sword? That when the government, takes on the power to kill, that we can understand that power in, or legitimize that power without drawing on conceptual resources of retribution.
Yeah, I think so. And the example I give, I don't know if it maybe hadn't occurred to me when I was first writing about these things, but when parents punish children, unless there's something extremely sick in the situation, they don't think of paying back. Mm. The punishment is functioning, doing something else. Mm-hmm. It is reproving with more or less forcefulness. Sometimes some words are sufficient for the reproof. Sometimes one says, hey, you got to stay in your room for an hour, and so forth. So I think punishment can be and should be thought of as reproof rather than...
Yeah, but it puts a constraint on punishment. That is, it's restorative or it's instructional or it's something else.
And also just announcing forcefully what you did was wrong. Right. One hopes that the same thing will also improve them, but sometimes just forcefully saying, look, I've got to do something more than words here.
Yeah.
To make clear to you that what you did was wrong.
Right. But then we think, once killing...
Now, yeah,
comes into the picture. That
starts to look a little bit less like.
Yeah, that's right. That the analogy between the parent child, but what makes it compelling is precisely that it has some restorative function or instructional function, even if it's not instructional for the child.
Bad parents don't typically exercise capital punishment.
Right, exactly.
So I think capital.
We may feel like
capital
it sometimes.
Punishment is out. Right, capital punishment is out.
Okay. So it's the limits on the sword, or how you think about the sword.
So if you think of it as reproof rather than retribution, then naturally the limitations on it are different.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And so how would you characterize those limitations? I mean, this is maybe indirectly getting at something else that Yoder thinks when Yoder's thinking about the church, the contrast society, and that as the way in which the church bears witness to something like the justice of the divine kingdom that serves as a witness to the state or something like that.
Yeah.
It's primarily surrounding this idea of enemy love rather than violence. And when violence gets glossed by Yoder in terms of the state power to kill. And so this is another way in which when you then say the God has given authority, perform a performative kind of authority to the state to reprove, and then this puts constraints on the sword. It raises the question, well, what kinds of constraints?
Yeah. So I wish I had more life ahead of me than I do. I would like to think hard about that. I've had some contact with people who, a little bit of contact with the prison system in Michigan and more contact with people who've got thick contact. So let me just be anecdotal at this point. So Calvin College has started a second campus in addition to its Knollcrest campus on the southeast corner of Grand Rapids. And the second campus is in Hanlon Prison, a state prison. Wow. Prisoners, a selection of prisoners, 20 each year, and then 20 new ones each year, can get a Calvin College AB while being in prison. They're taught regular Calvin College courses. They don't... Up to this point, they haven't sort of...
Changed the curriculum.
Yeah. So Kevin Corcoran, who was a philosopher in the Calvin department, was teaching one of these courses and invited me. They were discussing a book of mine, Lament for a Son, and the prisoners in Kevin's beginning philosophy course in Hanlon Prison learned that I was around. So would I come and talk to them about the book? It was a really moving experience. First, they've all got copies of my book, and they line up, want me to autograph them, which I did. And then all of them say, "How, Professor, how honored we are that you showed up. And so what's going on here is they just feel demeaned all the time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But then the discussion was, I think, better than any discussion I've ever had in any class I've taught. Mm-hmm. These are middle-aged people. 17 out of the 20 are lifers, and so forth. And I'm thinking of one of them especially, who was not a lifer, who was in there for a burglary. Bright, inquisitive. And I thought, this system, what's the point? Mm-hmm. What's the point? He's been reproved. He freely admits that what he did wrong, and he seems totally sincere. We're just wasting a life. I can't see what's going on here other than retribution. Just
right.
So what a system would look like if it went for reproof rather than retribution, I don't in detail know. Mm-hmm. But I do know that when I talk to these people, retribution just pervades mm-hmm. the system.
It wouldn't look like this, that's for
sure. Wouldn't look
right.
like this. Right. And I learned that the warden systematically tried to demean these people. Mm-hmm. At every point, want to make it clear who's in power, mm-hmm. where in power, mm-hmm. and don't you guys ever, mm-hmm. ever mistake it, and so forth.
Yeah.
So what in detail, I wish I had, had the time to think through what would a prison system look like if it operated on punishment as reproof.
And this is kind of what's at issue. These practical questions are part of what's at issue in thinking about the distinction between your kind of defense of government's role in curbing wrongdoing versus what somebody like Hauerwas and people who think of Hauerwas's picture as normative.
Yep.
If you take the off the table from the very beginning, the question of who is right about the role of government, or should both of you might be able to say things like the prison system, the American carceral system, or capital punishment, or something like that. These are real injustices and evils that are perpetrated by the state, and that Christian communities particularly have some responsibility to bear witness to this wrong kind of wrongdoing.
And try to cure it.
Ameliorate it somehow.
Yeah, ameliorate it, get rid of it, whatever.
Yeah, whatever. The question is how. And your picture encourages, or at least appears to encourage, a kind of Christian investment in political process.
Yeah.
Whereas Stanley's picture seems to encourage a kind of almost like a communal revolt of sorts. That is not a violent revolt because he's pacifistic after all, but rather one that is more, I mean, we might put it like this. You project what you might think of for a Christian perspective, as a foreign policy answer, whereas Stanley gives a domestic policy answer. Christian internal communal resources for addressing social problems versus channeling Christian energy into existing political systems.
So I think we should do both. I think the Christian community should be a model community in this regard, but that we should also do what we can to try to get the state to stop this retribution system.
Mm. Right. This is the thing that I find and have found frustrating among even teaching. I've taught some of your Justice, Rights, and Wrongs, as well as some of Miroslav Volf's A Public Faith, which is very much influenced by your work. And then when I was at Duke and precepting, similarly, some of Jeff Stout's stuff I taught. And so this kind of picture of Christian religious communities as attempting both and invested in. The frustration it raises is one of just limited constraints on our time and efforts. That is to say, Christian communities, in order to have an actual communal infrastructure, where it's not, oh, look, these are the same people I see at church every Sunday, but actual to have genuine Christian community, a sense of Christian community, is actually a very demanding thing. That is to say, so that on the one hand, but it's also extremely demanding to attempt to social change by way of political process. So in practice, you're giving up something in terms of...
Well, I think individuals are giving up something, but it's not clear to me that the community is giving up something. And so what happened in the case of Calvin and this new campus, Calvin and some church people appealed to a previous warden. He wanted nothing to do with it. Mm. Then a new warden came in, and he, for reasons, I don't know, he said, well, let's try it. And so Calvin wanted to avoid church-state issues, so they got the prison to give them a space, a room, and they would furnish it. And it's beautifully furnished. Actually, it's more handsomely furnished than any classroom that I ever taught at on the regular Norcrest campus. And what it says is, seems to me, architecturally, we honor you people. And then my coming, and they're saying in this moving way, we're so honored and so forth. So it's, they found a way, and a warden who was willing to be receptive of saying, you guys, okay, you're in here for life, rightly or wrongly. I mean, some of them talked openly about what they had done, how they'd murdered, which was amazing. I mean, here I'm. Well, I mean, what am I going to do with this information? But anyway, still, they don't know me. So I had this profound sense of they're being honored. And this, and there was enough energy around to be able to do that.
Yeah, right.
Now, it doesn't overturn the whole prison system, of course. But it's... might be a little flame that spreads.
I think one of the great things, the sort of good political things, is that there's a certain degree of bipartisan awareness of the condition. I mean, first of all, conditions in the prison, and then also the criminalization of things that maybe should.
And this raised no partisan issues. It just skirted all of that.
Yeah, but we can go on forever. Can we touch on liturgy?
Sure.
Samir had noted that very recently you've been starting to think and write about liturgy. Well, so I guess there was one book that's a little bit more theological.
Yeah.
But then you just came out with the book. Is it out now?
No, it's just sent to Oxford 3 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it'll be coming out in 2017.
Yeah.
And the title of that book is?
Acting Liturgically.
Okay, and that's...
Philosophical Reflections on Religious Practice.
Okay. And then Samir had this question about, like, the relationship between the liturgy stuff and the justice stuff. And then I went back and I was actually looking at Until Justice and Peace Embrace, because I hadn't read that in a good long time. And then I saw that there's a chapter there on liturgy.
Yeah.
And its relevance to justice. And so again, I wasn't sure if now you're gonna disappoint us. So the nice answer would be yes, Ed. I've been thinking about this for a long time, and I wanted to return to these themes of justice. And then once I did, I wanted to tie that in with liturgy. But now you're gonna just say it was accidental.
Yeah, right. This was an architectonic plan.
Yeah. I've been planning this since I was 25.
That's right. Finally realized.
I wrote those early essays. Those essays earlier about the relation of liturgy to justice, but what spurred this liturgy book, I've got to give a longer answer. So the book that's been out for a couple of years, The God We Worship, that's another book I hadn't really planned. But the people at Deerfield Evangelical Seminary, Trinity Evangelical Seminary in Deerfield, Illinois, they've got a series going, cancer lecture series, on what they call revelational theology as opposed to natural theology in the Gifford lecture series. Mm-hmm. So they came to me and asked me to give a set of lectures in that series. And I said, but I'm not a theologian, and this is a series in revelational theology. They said, yeah, well, we know that. But you do write and talk quite a bit about God. Well, yes. So after thinking it over, this is over a lunch, after eating a bit and thinking, I say, well, how about a series of lectures on liturgy? No, it's got to be about God. So finally it occurred to me, well, how about the God we worship? Fine. So that book, that's how that book happened. So it's not some big architectonic scheme, okay? So that's what it is, the understanding of God implicit in Christian worship. Uh-huh. But I did still want to do a book on liturgy for two reasons. I've long been interested in liturgy. And the renaissance in philosophy of religion that has occurred, especially in the analytic tradition over the past 40 years, has concentrated heavily on religious belief. If you knew nothing about religion and just read the philosophical literature, you'd think that religion is almost entirely about believing things about God, plus some rare mystical experiences if they read Bill Alston and so forth. Whereas I think for almost all adherents of almost all religions, religious practice looms more prominently in their lives. I mean, they believe things, but so I long wanted to write such a book to do what I could to cure my fellow philosophers of their myopia, their focus on them. So that's what it is. Insofar as philosophers have written about liturgy, which is very little, it's been almost always on the formative effects of liturgy. Howard Wass writes about, theologian about the formative effects.
Or Jamie Smith's recent.
And Jamie Smith's is about the formative effects. I wanted to talk about what we do in liturgy, because it's what we do that's formative, it's not something else. In addition to what we do, that's formative, but the doing is the formative thing. And so what we do is, in a way, the basic thing. So the book is about what do we do when we assemble to enact a liturgy.
And this is distinct from giving, a theology of liturgy.
Yes.
Which you would find in, like, Schmemann or Chauvet or people like that.
Yeah, there are lots of theology of liturgy, and I've read some of them. I think the best is Alexander Schmemann from the Orthodox tradition and Jean-Jacques Van Almen from the Swiss Reformed tradition. Mm-hmm. For reasons that I don't understand, the theologians tend to operate at a very high level of generality in contrast to the historians. So I found the historians actually of more help and interest than the theologians. Sometimes they're of help. So I get into the fine texture of liturgy. I don't want just to generalize about it. So here's an example that I give people, which has intrigued me for 15, 20 years. On Christmas and New Year, and often on Good Friday, the hymns we sing, Orthodox, Catholic, and Protestant alike, are in the present tense. Christ the Lord is risen today. Alleluia. Hark, the herald angels sing. We can only hearken to the herald angels singing when they're singing.
Not when they've sung.
Not when they've sung. Why do we cast, what's going on? Why do we cast our hymns into the present tense? What's going on? That's just one example of what are we doing?
Uh-huh. But it seems like there's two directions you might go there. One might be to say, what is presupposed in the action? That is to say, what's implicit in it?
Yeah, there's got to be.
That makes sense of it. But then seems to me that giving, say, a metaphysics or something of liturgy could be a larger project than just what's implicit. So you might say that, I mean, to bring out what's, to talk about, make explicit what's implicit, seems to necessarily appeal to more about our dispositions, our training, and that.
Yeah,
kind of thing.
Someone's got to get into, right, it opens up, I think ordinary experience illuminates, some parts of ordinary experience illuminate what goes on in the liturgy, and what goes on in the liturgy illuminates broader experience and personality and so forth, yeah.
But one kind of, say, more metaphysical.
But I don't want to run away. So Jamie Smith will also talk about the liturgy, the rituals of shopping.
Right.
Now, I've got no objection to it, but I think liturgy in the strict sense is so full of challenges to understanding and interest that I don't want to run away from it to other things.
Right. I mean, but so, you know, when you talk about theologians who talk about this thing as kind of talking at a level of generality and this kind of thing, one of the things you also find is that they give large, overdetermined metaphysical
views. Yes, that's true. Yes,
views.
That's true.
So that is to say, what's happening when we use the present tense? Well, time is caught up in eternity. And so what does that mean? Well, it means that the church's reenactment is a kind of participation in the original event, and it's kind of because time doesn't have the same significance.
They even say stronger things. We react; the church reactualizes, makes present once again.
That's right.
Over-inflated metaphysics. And when you put your head to it, you say, really? I'm dubious that past events can be reactualized.
Right.
But let's forget that. What would happen if the event of Christ's birth were reactualized in my church? A young woman would give birth to a...
Yeah, that'd be something.
That'd be something. It's never happened.
But
so yeah, right. This inflated metaphysics.
Right. So, but one of the things that occurs to me is why you think about that kind of picture is that when you ask somebody who a theologian who takes that gives an account of that sort, I mean, one way they might describe what they're doing is to say that they're making implicit what is quote unquote really going on.
Yeah, I suppose. When we do, right? Yeah.
And so, would you distinguish?
But the metaphysics that they wind up with seems to me so dubious that.
Sure. So would you say that what you're engaged in is the same kind of thing, but on a different substantive view of your metaphysics and so on? Or would you say that the project is essentially a different kind of project?
So it's on a continuum with it. But when you read Schmemann, von Almond, Jamie, Hauerwas, they seldom quote actual liturgical texts,
right.
Actual liturgical examples. The historians do, of course, yeah. but they seldom do. It's at this level of generality. So it's it's not a totally different project, but mm-hmm. I don't know why they are so general. Here's one that a friend of mine, Terence Cuneo. Do you know Terence?
Yeah.
Terence is Orthodox. He gave me this one. In the Orthodox liturgy on Maundy Thursday, the Orthodox liturgy opens by the people, choir, whatever, the people singing, "When I, Adam, fell," and then follows a 200-word lament. Now, I think that's fascinating. When I'm there and I'm saying, "When I, Adam, fell," what's going on? What am I doing? And I don't want to dash off into big generalizations at that point.
Right,
I want to know
right.
this. So for me, what's helped is my work in aesthetics,
yep.
Drama, role playing,
performance,
speech act theory. All of that has helped to illuminate mm-hmm. what's going on in these puzzles. You know, when you think about it, puzzling things. Mm-hmm. Now, most people use the present tense on Christmas, Easter, and Good Friday without ever thinking about it.
Right.
So a natural question is, why is it so natural for them? Why doesn't it ever jolt them?
I'm just trying to think if that's a characteristic. Is that a general characteristic of just those special few days, or is that...
It happens a bit oftener, but it's especially on those 3 days.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And there is, particularly for the...
Maybe... Be interesting whether it happens on Pentecost. I would guess that a few Pentecost mm-hmm. hymns are also in the present
yeah.
tense. I would guess.
Yeah.
I haven't actually looked it up.
Yeah.
But that's my hunch.
And there's something about, I mean, just even the significance of the liturgical calendar for those who keep one, for Christians who keep
mm-hmm.
one.
Yeah.
That is to say, when you enter into these particular seasons that reenact, you know, or point towards different moments in the progression of the gospel
yep.
story and this kind of thing, that you have something like the same function as the present tense
yeah.
function. That is to say, we are going through this these seasons
yeah.
In a way that that's more than just recounting them
yeah.
or something like that.
So in my discussion, I want to keep it fairly close to the ground and
mm-hmm.
so that people will emerge illuminated, understanding better what they're doing and not just operate in high-level generalizations about time and eternity and things like that. Eternity swallows up time.
Yeah.
And
I don't often think of myself at Easter as reenacting Jesus' resurrection in the church at that
you do.
Moment. I don't.
No. So I have a chapter on reenactments.
Uh-huh.
It's a common liturgical...
Well, it's, yeah, especially
often
on Good Friday.
Yeah,
especially on Good Friday, right? Where they're.
I think there's not much true reenactment in present day liturgies.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, in medieval liturgies, there was a great deal. They really did
uh-huh.
do little performances.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, at the Episcopal Church that we went to in Baton Rouge at the Good Friday service, we would always read the Passion narrative, right, where the
mm-hmm.
crowd.
Yeah, where you read parts.
Yeah,
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 yeah.
yeah. Well,
you didn't do a reenactment. You didn't
Well, we participated in
you
the reading of those portions of the text.
But you didn't hold a meal in a small room and then
emerge
and and somebody slice off the ear of somebody.
No, no.
Or pretend to do so.
No.
Yeah. But an analysis of what's happening in these liturgical acts has got to be distinct from something psychological.
Yes.
Kind of.
Yeah.
You know. Because
I mean, it's often said that what we're doing is expressing our feelings of gratitude and so forth. And I think to thank God is different from expressing feelings, having and feeling expressions of thankfulness.
Right.
We're actually thanking God.
Mm-hmm.
And so right away you have a question: can you thank God without at the moment feeling thankful? Is it right, if you can, is it right to thank God without at the moment feeling thankful? So I have a chapter on what are non-believers doing when they participate in liturgical reenactments.
Mm. Do you talk about open tables and so on in Eucharist?
No. But that's, I mean,
it's a straightforward example of, I mean, yep. Controversies about that. But, you know, whether one rationale for saying that, say, only baptized Christians can have the Eucharist is that it actually harms someone who's a non-Christian to participate in the Eucharist because
you can quote certain words of Paul to sort of unruly Corinthians to that effect.
Right. Yeah. So it would be interesting to give an account of what kind of, in what way they're wronging.
Anyway, so that's the book that I've just sent off to Oxford, which they're agreed to publish.
Great. But again, no great grand architectonic.
No, this is not the 13th volume in my 13 volume system.
Well, if it had been planned out that way, then I think that would have been well planned.
Yeah, except what would I do with the rest of my life?
Well,
what?
Well, you know, like when so Tom Wright in some ways is an example of a system builder.
Yeah,
which is like that's system building at its best. Like, you know, I eagerly await the publication of the next volume and find the way that the whole thing hangs together.
Yeah,
and you know, and what kind of New Testament scholar is sort of spending a whole book just working at methodological issues of interpretation?
Right.
But you know, but the book, the series originally started off as 5 books. Is that right?
Yeah, I think.
And now it's. He's written 5 books already, I think, and maybe he's not anywhere near.
He's prolific.
Indeed.
So you need to keep adding.
Fluent.
I was going to actually follow up on the liturgy, and you know, having looked at this, the God We Worship book, and the way that it, I mean, one way of thinking about that book is that it what it's making explicit is a kind of theology proper that's implicit. But would you say similarly that there's an ecclesiology or there's a, I mean, because more than just even being a theology proper, that book is a way of making explicit the kind of mutual relations between us and God that are enacted in our
that
worship
are implicit,
practices.
Yeah, right.
But are there similarly, is there something similar to be said about the kind of church world relation that is implicit?
Sure.
Given that it was
in this theology series,
right? You had these constraints. Does your new book do much? Is your new book sort of working out a theology in a similar way, or is it just an analysis of a liturgical act?
Well, but no, it's more an analysis of liturgical act. But it gets into, so there's a chapter on the bodily dimension of worship, and so there you get into body and not just body, but also we wave palm branches and sprinkle with water or dunk in water and you know, all of that.
Yeah.
So the body and the world are involved.
Mm-hmm.
Also have a chapter then, well, this gets back to where we began. I hesitated writing a chapter on liturgy and justice because I said to myself, I've done that. I don't have anything new to say. Mm-hmm. And then there were friends who said, you've got to have a chapter on, you cannot not have a chapter on liturgy and justice. Oh, okay, so what do you So finally it occurred to me, this is what I do. At the heart of the Christian liturgy is the Eucharist, and at the heart of the Eucharist is the celebration, if, well, celebration, memorial, remembrance, of an incredible act of violent injustice, the killing of the one we worship. So that's about this mysterious, if you thought about it in advance, absolutely puzzling phenomenon. These people are worshiping. These people are worshiping somebody who was a victim of, well, lynching. Mm-hmm. What's going on? So that's what the last chapter is about. And I used a book by James Cone, The Cross and the Lynching Tree. His argument that central in African American liturgies has been the cross. And the reason that is so central is that they identify.
Right.
Identification is going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the liturgy and justice kind of connection is what's motivating my question about this whether the church some kind of church world relation can be made explicit in liturgy. I'm thinking of have you seen the Blackwell Companion to Christian Ethics that Hauerwas and Sam Wells edited?
Yeah, I don't know it.
It's organized.
I know of it, but I don't know it.
It's organized according to the liturgy.
Oh, really?
So all the topics are ordered according to the ordering of a worship service, such that, say, peacemaking and human reconciliation is discussed under the passing of the peace. And so all of the kind of moments in the Christian liturgy can be sort of, I mean, one thing that the book's attempting to do is unpack, so to speak, the moral significance of these different moments of the liturgy. But what that structuring lacks is any account of what it might mean to say that a certain account of reconciliation is actually implicit in the passing of the peace.
Yeah.
And so it seems to me that your new project and the kind of project in theological ethics represented by the Blackwell Companion might be a fruitful couple of
Yeah, because I don't go off so much into... I mean, at each point I could say this leads us into 5 chapters about reconciliation.
Sure.
I want to stick... So reconciliation. I chapter about the liturgical enactment of love, and how from the very beginning Jesus already, and then the Didache, before you give your sacrifice, be reconciled, and the passing of the peace is or can be an indication of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We should probably wrap it up. We've been going for more than 2 hours.
Okay.
Have we? Oh.
Well, I'm very glad then that there wasn't a big, grand 13-part series. So now we eagerly await the next big thing. and you can get to these questions.
Yeah, that's great.
It's a good thing you didn't put yourself in a corner. But we're very grateful for the chance to talk, Nick.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks for listening to our show. We are happy to be part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. For more information about all of the shows in the family, the Christian Humanist radio show itself, the Christian Feminist show, the Sectarian Review, the Book of Nature, the Profiles podcasts, as well as our own show, please visit christianhumanist.org. You can email Coil and I directly at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com or like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. And as always, let me remind all of you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and to render unto God those things that are God.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking, that ribbon of high...